So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
Said it's the Splatterific Splatterhouse, so I am legally required to tell the first four rows you're in the splash zone. So, without further ado, the Retronauts.
Hello, everybody. Is your mic on, Jeremy?
It says on. Oh, no. There we go.
Yeah.
Hi, everyone. He was kidding about the splash zone. We're more Galaga than Gallagher.
Hey, did you just think of that?
I did.
That was great.
That guy's shirt right there says Galaga.
I like it. I like it.
I can borrow a pun. Hi, Ken. Nice shirt. Are we ready to go?
Yeah, should we introduce ourselves to everybody in case there's any newcomers?
Well, we'll do the podcast thing.
We'll
do it up like an episode.
Okay.
So, this week in Retronauts, Splatterhouse. The music is in your head and your hearts. Just imagine it right now. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the second ever Retronauts panel at Midwest Gaming Classic. We are Retronauts, a video game podcast about, yes, classic games. And this week, or this year, I guess, we're talking about Splatterhouse because we have some experts here. So we'll just do a quick intro for ourselves. I'm Jeremy Parrish, one of the co-hosts of the show.
I am Bob Mackey. I'm here to make the Splatterhouse a splatter home.
I'm Kevin Bunch. I think I'm talking too close to the mic.
He's the TurboGrafx-16 high score world record holder for Splatterhouse. I'm Caitlin Oliver. I broke the world record for the arcade version of Splatterhouse about 7 or 8 times.
So Bob and I are basically idiots when it comes to Splatterhouse, but we thought since we're here in the presence of two world-class players of the game, we should pick their brains and let them tell us.
They're so important.
Tell you all about the series.
They're so important they have to travel here separately. They're not allowed to be in the same car or plane.
That's right. We can't lose both at the same time. So let's just go ahead and kick in with this discussion and talk about the original Splatterhouse, which is an arcade game developed by Namco, debuted in 1988. And actually, why don't I let you guys talk about it instead of me droning?
He's going to pass that one on me. Yeah, it was developed in 88. It did actually have a U.S. port, but it wasn't widely distributed, so it's pretty rare. At this point, it kind of be an expensive PCB unless you get a good deal. There were minor changes made to the U.S. port, mostly regarding removing religious imagery, but that didn't happen until it got ported to console. It's a brawler, a side-scrolling beat-em-up. There's 7 levels, and the scoring game mostly revolves around levels 6 and on, because the rest of the game is a giant pattern. If you're willing to learn it, it's not really that bad. You can beat the game in about 20 minutes, but a score run takes about 45 minutes to an hour straight.
We should probably point out it's a very gory game. It's a horror-themed game, so the whole premise is your character Rick and his girlfriend Jennifer went into a creepy mansion.
The West Mansion.
The West Mansion.
Of which there is also a resource website run by Rob Strangman. Yeah.
The lights go out, she has a scream, he wakes up with a creepy mask on his face and just goes forth and beats
up. It's called the terror mask.
And beats up gross little monsters.
I mean, I think we're bearing the lead in that this is sort of the Friday the 13th unlicensed game, spun out of the 80s exploitation horror. And you have some examples there, Jeremy, right?
No, not really, but okay.
I thought you had... You literally have a bunch.
I have a lot of notes, but nothing really about Friday the 13th, because I'm not really that familiar with the movies.
Well, I mean, he is based on the design of Jason in his... I mean, he looks like he's wearing scrubs in this game.
Right,
but yeah. It's more of a blue jumpsuit.
It's Dr. Jason Voorhees.
Yeah.
Dr. Voorhees to the manor, please.
But it...
It's a little bit Reanimator, as in the Stuart Gordon adaptation of the H.P. Lovecraft story, Herbert West Reanimator.
Yeah, so the context of the game itself is, it actually feels a little bit like a game out of time, because it is, a very sort of linear belt scroller, as opposed to the three-quarters perspective Double Dragon Final Fight style game that most people think of when they think of beat-em-ups. And Double Dragon had launched just the year before, so it hadn't quite become widely cloned yet. So you kind of had this change happening in the beat-em-up genre, and Splatterhouse feels a little bit like, sort of the old guard, the last of the old guard. And Namco had actually produced a few games in that style up until this point. There was Wonder Momo, which I don't think came to the U.S., but it was an arcade game in Japan. And then there was the Genji and Heike clans. And both of those were also that sort of 2D belt scroller, very memorization-based, beat-em-up kind of brawler. But they all had different themes. Genji and Heike clans was sort of like Japanese medieval horror with lots of yokai and spirits. And Wonder Momo was more like a Power Rangers, Sailor Moon stage play, Sentai, yeah. And so you kind of had all these different themes happening. Splatterhouse then was sort of the Hollywood, gory, Evil Dead, Friday the 13th kind of game.
I don't mean to slander the game by saying this, but it feels kind of like Altered Beast, with how you're on one plane, things explode in one hit, and there's a lot of violence for the most part.
But in this one, you get a cleaver.
It's not unlike Altered Beast. That's true.
The shotgun.
Good, I didn't
think
of
the shotgun. Altered Beast, if that had a shotgun,
oh, it'd be much better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
I respect that.
Yeah. And it's not a long game, like Caitlin said. You can plow through it if you know what you're doing. There is a fair amount of memorization to it. It's not as bad as some memorization-heavy games, like R-Type or something, but...
It's not a shmup level of memorization. It's the enemies legitimately spawn in the same place every time, short of maybe two or three places.
Yeah, and if you know they're coming, you can prepare for them. The bosses, they all tend to have sort of the same pattern that you can exploit.
Yeah, so it's worth mentioning that this game was really sort of pushing the envelope in terms of what was acceptable in terms of gore and violence in the arcade. I mean, it was probably the most gruesome game to come out in arcades since Chiller, which was a game specifically designed to be disgusting and gross, and you're like using a light gun to dismember people. This wasn't quite like that. But it sort of took the sort of prevailing body horror theme that was showing up in a lot of games around that time and sort of pushed the envelope a little further and made it even more gruesome, very bloody, like there's guts splattering everywhere. I mean, there's a reason it's called Splatterhouse. It's a very, very literal sort of name. But if you look at something like Contra or Abadox, you had a lot of these games where it was about, like, walking inside of giant monsters and beating up their corpuscles and punching their organs and that sort of thing, and this was very much along those lines, but sort of presented in a slasher movie kind of style.
Yeah, encountering this game as a kid, I was afraid of the box. Sort of just like walking by the horror aisle in the video store, just like, I'm sure if I watch any of these movies, I would literally die of fright. So I assumed I would die if I played Splatterhouse.
I rented this game as a kid because I love the box so much, and my dad let me pick it. My dad got me a TurboGrafx when I was young, and that's my toe. But no, he got me a TurboGrafx when I was young, and I remember renting it from the local video store. I never got it until I was older, but I was obsessed with the game. And I figure if a kid like me could get pretty far, I couldn't regularly beat it, but if I could get that far, if you're willing and you're ready to learn how to play the game and memorize it, you too can pretty easily beat that game.
And, you know, when you're speaking of the body horror, what springs to mind is a few of the different bosses. Like, you've got Biggie Man, who is this giant with a burlap sack over his head and chainsaws for hands. You've got Jennifer is a boss. I don't know if that's a spoiler at this point. But she mutates into this hideous monster with claws. And stage six is basically a giant womb of the house, and you're fighting little monster fetuses.
I do think it's a bit cute with how they did the most low-effort change to protect themselves from lawsuits for the home version. They basically just made Rick's mask purple. And that's kind of like making a movie called Nightmare on Oak Street with Eddie Krueger. The stripes on the sweater go a different way, so you can't sue us.
So one of the reasons I wanted the two of you to come in and talk about this is because I'm honestly curious, like, why did you two pick this game to be sort of your expert level project? Like, what inspired Splatterhouse specifically?
With me, I always loved horror movies. I've been obsessed, unsurprisingly, since I was a little kid. My mom claims that when I was 3, my favorite movie was Night of the Living Dead, and I'd cry if they turned off the channel. I don't remember that, but I don't see why she'd make it up. But ever since then, I loved the horror genre, which is why I picked up the game as a kid. I obsessively played it as a kid, and when I went to Galloping Ghost in 2012 or so, that was the first time I had seen the arcade machine in my life, so I decided I was going to keep playing it. Somebody asked me if I was going to go for a world record. I said no, I hadn't been planning on it, but then I decided why not. And I did it. It only took like 3 weeks, because what I did was I started to memorize the patterns I was missing from the other world record holder, Anthony Paparo, who I went back and forth with several times. Great guy. And I watched his video to get some techniques, and then we've built upon each other's techniques since then to push the score from around 375-ish thousand to right now it's just at past 700,000. So in the last 3 years, we about doubled the old record.
In the past few weeks, you said?
Well, in the past 3 years.
Oh, years.
Going back and forth.
That makes more sense.
Yeah, something like that. Shoot, I was going to say something about the game. Oh, the biggest problem I see with people who pick up this game is they try to play it like other brawlers and proactively attack enemies. It's something you don't do.
Yeah, so you mentioned that a straight playthrough of the game takes about 20 minutes, but a high score approach takes 45, 50. So can you talk about what's going on there?
Sure. So in the spirit of waiting for enemies to come to you and get into your range to hit them, which is a huge mechanic in the game, you spend, since all of the enemies spawn in a pattern, the game largely has a set number of points that are possibly achievable on your way to stage 6. Stage 6 is one of the first and only places in the game with randomly spawning enemies that will endlessly spawn until the actual timer runs out. So you use that to continue padding for points. And the reason that's not considered an exploit for this particular game is because there are a limited number of lives, which I discovered by pushing the score to 450,000 points, because that's the last point at which you actually get an extra life. So it's 11 lives total, I believe you have. And then going through stage 7, you get a 100,000 point bonus from the boss. There's also a method to farm that particular boss for points, but that's considered an exploit because you're not supposed to be able to get that bonus multiple times.
So,
you can agree or disagree, those are just the current rules.
So the finite number of lives, basically you're farming for points on stage 6 and then dying and then doing it again?
Yep.
So that's not like super riveting to watch, I'm assuming.
No, it is boring to tears. I feel bad for anybody who really wants to watch anybody else play it. Playing it is hard enough. I mean, it's not that it's so difficult to learn in general, but pushing the points at high can get really difficult and time-consuming, and you learn when to start cutting off runs and just killing yourself off to save yourself time because you know it's not worth the time to finish.
So I never actually grew up with Splatterhouse. Like, I read about it in magazines, but I didn't have a TurboGrafx, so I never got to play it. And then I think around 2000, 2001, I remember reading about it and thinking, oh, hey, I could try it on an emulator, except all the TurboGrafx emulators at the time were terrible. So I just kind of forgot about it again for years. Finally picked it up in 2010. Was terrible at it. I think I got up to stage 3 and kept dying. Said, all right, I'll just come back to this some other day. And then I met Caitlin through a mutual friend of mine, who... This was right about when you set the record for Splatterhouse.
And shortly after.
Shortly after that. And then I remembered, oh yeah, Splatterhouse is a game. I should see if I can figure that out again. So I was able to pick her brain to actually figure out how to play the game, like, effectively. After a couple of weeks, I managed to finish the game. And, you know, I had a lot of fun with it and thought, well, what the hey, I'll see if I can go for the TurboGrafx record. It's not too bad. And a lot of the same strategies do carry over. It's a pretty good port. Like, the only major difference is, you know, some of the stages are a little easier. You get the hitboxes are a little more generous for Rick. Like, you can hit enemies further away, and you don't get hit as easily. You get 2 hearts back when you finish a stage instead of 1 heart for your life meter. And I think... most weirdly is there's no timer on the stages. Like, you can just sort of hang back and nothing will force you to move forward or kill you. As far as I can tell, there's only 1 boss, and that's the stage 6 boss, where you can't just hang out forever without the timer happening. It's an interesting port. I mean, they did cut the religious imagery, like Yacht mentioned. It's solid. Like,
a few crosses got cut.
Yeah, there's a few crosses. They took out an upside down cross of the stage 4 boss and the religious altar in the church. I mean, you can pick up this version on the Wii Virtual Console still, I think.
You can pick it up on Virtual Console, or you can get it on the 2010 copy of Splatterhouse because it does have the arcade port on it.
You probably want to get it on Virtual Console, though, because then you don't have to buy the 2010 game.
But you can get it so cheap, and it has all 4 games on
it. That's true.
It's like $15, $17, and it has Splatterhouse, Splatterhouse 2, Splatterhouse 3, and 2010.
So the TurboGrafx port was not the only home version of Splatterhouse. It also came to FM Towns Marty. Are you guys in contact with the world record holder for the FM Towns Marty version?
He has to be in prison, right?
If he ever wants to see his little dog again, he'll do what I say.
So I'm taking that's a no. Caitlin, you mentioned that Anthony Paparo, I think you said his name was?
Yeah, Anthony Paparo.
Paparo, okay. He's sort of the other guy who has the record, and you're competing with him and collaborating with him.
Yep.
Is Splatterhouse like a hotly contested game in terms of the record chase?
It was hotly contested between myself and Anthony, but not really otherwise. But that doesn't... there was another man at the arcade who was picking it up, and he got to around 650 and quit because he didn't think he could push it further. But there's definitely room for improvement. I've thought out approximate caps of scores. Like, realistically speaking, I don't think you get it for too much further past 850,000. But... maybe a miracle. Who knows?
Are you disappointed that no documentarian ever followed you and Anthony to create, like, the King of Kong for Splatterhouse, the King of Manor?
No, I'm not at all. Because I've dealt with documentarians, and I don't like them one bit. They were some shady people.
I do want to see what kind of barbecue sauce the Billy Mitchell of Splatterhouse makes.
Well, he makes pretty... Well, I tell you, Billy Mitchell makes pretty good hot sauce. I have some from him that he gifted me because I beat Billy Mitchell at Pac-Man. It was Pac-Man Battle Royale. It's not that cool, but it was pretty cool.
you know, before we move on to the rest of the Splatterhouse series, is there anything more to say about the original game? Like, what specifically would you say is your favorite element of the game, both as a like a high score competitor and just someone who plays the game for fun?
I love the music for that game. It's a really good soundtrack.
Yeah, it's really atmospheric. I was going to say the atmosphere to the game is just really, it's really oppressive and.
There was nothing quite like really, it in 1988. It was just fascinating. Because even with Chiller, which is, as we mentioned, the game Exidy made before it, the graphics are so rudimentary, to put it nicely, that the gore element is there, but it just looks so... It's like a child's...
It's like Torquemada. It's like Torquemada playing around in MS Paint. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not attractive.
I mean, think, you know, Texas Chainsaw Massacre on Atari 2600. We're not talking super gory. So the first time you see this, it was like, are they allowed to do this with video games? Can they do that? Is that cool? Which is why, like, you could only really find it in bars, and you know. Establishments that didn't let kids play games, because that wouldn't be suitable for a kid, no sir.
Yeah, the home version even has a little warning on it, not suitable for younger children, which is
prior to any sort of rating system existing, no ESRB.
Which is funny, since the home version's it's still kind of gory, but they've toned it down a lot compared to the arcade.
But graphic restrictions more than just toning it down for the sake of toning it down.
So any final, I guess we have done our final thoughts on Splatterhouse, in which case that means it's time to move on to my favorite Splatterhouse game, which is also probably the least real Splatterhouse game. Maybe the LCD handheld game would be a little like the Tiger Electronics version, but... there's a Japanese version, or a Japanese game that came out for the Famicom family computer called Wanpaku Splatter, or Wanpaku Graffiti Splatterhouse, which means naughty graffiti.
And you don't actually spend that much time inside of the Splatterhouse.
No, you are inside.
A few times, but you're also in Japan at some point, and...
I would say, relative to the other games in the series, this is actually the least naughty Splatterhouse, despite the title.
It's silly.
Yeah, so Splatterhouse came out in 1988, and nothing really happened with the series aside from some ports until 1992, and all of a sudden there were two games. There was Wanpaku Graffiti, and then there was Splatterhouse 2 for Genesis. But before we get on to Splatterhouse 2, which is kind of more of the same, it's worth talking about this weird game, because I picked up a copy of it recently and discovered it on a video stream. And it was not what I was expecting. I was thinking more like a horror game, but it's more like a parody of horror movies. It's really fast-paced, unlike Splatterhouse. It's not so much about memorization and precision. It's very goofy. The first boss you fight, you don't actually fight him. He's a vampire who pops out of the grave, and then there's four zombies who pop up. And this disco light comes on, and they start dancing, and they do a Thriller routine. And then the zombies come down while the vampire keeps doing the Thriller routine, and you have to fight the zombies. And then once you beat all the zombies, you don't fight the vampire. He just descends back into his grave and gives you, like, a, you know, victory sign.
There's a similar boss where you basically just watch a geisha dance, and you hit the buttons to, like, cheer, and then I guess you're so rude she gives you one of the crystals you're looking for.
That's not quite correct.
I didn't find
you
that secret.
You can cheer by clapping, but the other button allows you to fart.
Oh.
And if you continue to fart, that's when she'll call you very rude, but she'll still give you the crystal ball.
So farting is the pro tip here.
Yeah, so it's a very cutesy, cartoony kind of game. Like I said, it's very fast-paced. Rick always has an axe instead of having to punch things with his fist. You can pick up a shotgun, which has a great piercing effect. It's, like, super powerful and awesome, and it's very exciting to use because it's so powerful. But, it's pretty much, you know, kind of like a more traditional home-style game. And then it's really the bosses that are sort of the highlights, because each of them is a different horror movie parody. You get to a place, like, you've been fighting these things that kind of look like spiders, but then you're like, maybe those are supposed to be, you know, the little head crab guys from Aliens. And then you finally get to this table where there's a schoolgirl laying on the table, and her belly or chest starts to kind of like pulsate, and then the boss of that section is just an endless stream of those head crabs coming out. And once you finally defeated them all, she sits up, yawns, and wakes up, and like she's just been taking a nice nap. And I guess you kind of have to see it. It doesn't really explain so well.
I was watching a Let's Play of it today, and strangely enough, the fly boss looks like a California raisin, which is even more terrifying to me.
It's clearly Jeff Goldblum, but Jeff Goldblum as a California raisin.
That is somebody's fetish, so don't laugh.
By the way, the pro tip there is to go into the transformation pod. Once you go into the transformation pod, that's how you get to the geisha with the crystal.
And you have, like, you have the giant green rat that you just have to get through, like, an obstacle course to hit once, and then he just sort of splits open and the little mouse runs away. Wasn't there, like, a wizard boss?
In the early emulation days, I remember this game in Zero Wing being singled out for having really good, bad English, and the line that will stick with me for life is, "Be garbage of cesspool." So I guess that is the game taunting you, or saying that you are garbage of cesspool, but who knows, but I love it.
I mean, to be fair, Rick is pretty garbage of cesspool.
He really is.
I haven't actually been able to finish this game, because I've only played it the once, but... I got much further in that game than any other Splatterhouse game I played, so there's something to be said for that. And I think at the end you find out it's just like a play. It's not actually...
They're actually filming a movie, okay. So you're on the set of a movie.
There you go.
And by getting the crystals, you get a different ending for the movie.
But it's actually, in a sense, the most sophisticated Splatterhouse game to that point, more so than 1 or 2, because it has an upgrade system built into it, kind of like Bionic Commando. As you beat enemies, you gain extra life, so you can take more damage, which is, you know, kind of like a... You can definitely tell that it was a game designed for home play, and it was also designed for younger players. It's not gory at all. It's maybe a little gory.
Cartoon gory. It's not gory.
Yeah, there's a lot of poop jokes thrown in there too. So you get a little blood, a little poop. It's a healthy mix.
That's pretty standard kids media fare in Japan.
Oh yeah, yeah.
It's like a parodious game or something along those lines. I remember finding this one when I first started with emulations. I was just sort of fascinated at how bizarre this game is. I would call it secretly the best Splatterhouse game. It's also probably the least... I guess it's not the least accessible, but you have to go through emulation or find a Famicom card to play it.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
In video games, getting your hands on a new car is as easy as winning a few races and unlocking a new virtual garage option. Real life isn't so simple. If you think blue shells are out to get you, just wait till you try getting a fair, honest deal from a used car dealer. The good news? Real life has its own hot pro tip for unlocking a new or used car, and that's TrueCar. By dialing you in to actual sales data from more than 13,000 dealers, TrueCar can connect you with a local certified dealer and a network of more than 700,000 pre-owned vehicles for a fair and painless buying experience. TrueCar allows you to find the exact vehicle you want, whether new or used. And thanks to the TrueCar pricing curve, you can see what others in your area have paid for the same vehicle you're looking at. Plus, you'll be armed with the knowledge of all available sales incentives before you ever make it to the dealer's lot. That's why, on average, TrueCar users have saved more than $3,000 off the MSRP of their dream car across more than 3 million vehicles sold. Don't think of TrueCar as a cheat code so much as a code to avoid being cheated. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features are not available in all states.
This week on All of the Above with Norman Lear, Veep star Julia Louis-Dreyfus sits down with Norman and Paul.
Well, you know, there wasn't a script when I was first talking to HBO about it. There wasn't a concept. And my agent had said to me, listen, they're developing this thing at HBO about an unhappy vice president, an unhappy female vice president. And I thought to myself, well, I got to get in on this action because it's gold and it's so amazing that nobody's done it before.
Listen today on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or on PodcastOne.com.
But I definitely recommend this one just for people to try out because it is, like Kevin said, the least accessible and the least known Splatterhouse game. And it's a very different experience. So if the guts and gore don't really do much for you, try out Wanpaku Graffiti. And it's a different experience that still kind of has that Splatterhouse vibe. On the other hand, Splatterhouse 2 for Genesis was much more of a traditional Splatterhouse game, which is to say it feels very much like the continuation of the first game. And the sort of origin of this game is a little weird because there were a couple of Namco series that started in the arcade and then for whatever reason just continued on Genesis. This was one of them, and Rolling Thunder was one of them. And I don't know exactly why this happened, but it is this kind of odd little quirk of fate that, you know, these Namco sequels appeared on Sega Genesis. But I would say that Splatterhouse 2 is much more authentic, much more in keeping with the design and aesthetics and overall feel of the first Splatterhouse than Rolling Thunder 2 was. I know you guys don't play this one for world records, but do you have much to say about this one?
You might have more to say about it than I do. I don't have a whole lot to say because I didn't really have a Genesis growing up. So I came into this one pretty late. I still like 2 and 3, which were both Mega Drive sequels, but I'm just not quite as knowledgeable about them as the rest. They're still good games, though, and the second one is certainly the most faithful to the original in presentation and style and method.
I found Splatterhouse 2. I think it might be my least favorite of the old ones, just because it does the exact same thing as the arcade version, except it seems much more memorization heavy. It's a lot harder to make any progress in it. They do some cool things. Like, you have some really creative bosses, like the murder shed where little creepy babies come down from the ceiling and vomit on you, and you have to take a chainsaw to them. But yeah, it just doesn't work for me very well.
I fully endorse taking chainsaws to mutated infants.
But it is also on the Wii.
Yeah, it really feels like they were kind of trying to push the limits of what you could do on a console with this one. Not in terms of technical limitations, but in terms of taste. The murder shed is definitely sort of the pinnacle of that. Like, it starts out with a pair of gardening shears and a chainsaw flying around at you, and you have to punch them out of the air because apparently you can punch chainsaws in this game. And then once you punch the chainsaw out of the air, then you use it to cut the fetuses that descend on their umbilical cords from the ceiling until a face appears and you have to, like, punch it to death. It's terrible, it's horrible, but it's also kind of, like, a little cool in the audacity of it. Like, I can't believe that they did this. And surprisingly, this game didn't show up in the congressional hearings about video game
violence. They were paying attention. Joe Lieberman was really asleep at the switch for this. I did want to mention, though, they did change the mask in both versions. In the Japanese version, it looks like sort of like Fanto, but all white. And in the American version, it's like this grinning skull. So they were trying to step away from Friday the 13th, even with this sequel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Marginally.
Yeah. He was still dressed in the Jason scrubs, though.
Yeah. They filed off the serial numbers with a little more enthusiasm this time. But yeah, I've played some of this recently, and it doesn't really do that much for me because, like Kevin said, it is extremely memorization-based. And I got to the part, I guess it's like level 4, where you're trying to escape across a dock while this giant squid comes behind you and destroying the dock. And there's enemies coming at you from the other direction, and you have to take them out with like a perfect rhythm by doing jump kicks and things. And if you screw up even once, then you'll kind of fall behind, and the squid will kill you, and it's an instant death, which I basically burned through like 2 continues trying to get past that and couldn't. So maybe I just don't know the magic technique, but it was extremely difficult and unforgiving, which, I don't know. I guess, some people enjoy that, but this doesn't really do much for me. Okay, Caitlin's giving the thumbs up, so clearly it's her kind of game. Splatterhouse 3, I think, is more my speed because it does feel like a real Splatterhouse game, but one designed more with the console market in mind. And this one came out just a year after Splatterhouse 2. It was like 4 years between 1 and 2 and then 1 year between 2 and 3. So it seems like they kind of... I don't know. Splatterhouse 2 was really a throwback in 1992, doing that sort of belt-scroller, very limited 2D design, whereas Splatterhouse 3 is much more in the sort of mode of popular beat-em-ups at that point, the sort of three-quarters perspective, Final Fight, Streets of Rage, you know, move around, that had exploration and multiple endings and all kinds of extra goodies. So maybe someone else can talk now.
I actually really enjoyed Splatterhouse 3. If not for Juan Paco Graffiti, I think it might actually be the best one. So like Jeremy said, there is a time limit on each stage, and if you don't finish the stage within that time limit, you get one step along to a bad ending. There's, what, four endings, I think, depending on whether or not Rick's wife and son live or die. They changed up the terror mask again to make it look... I think Rick is still kind of wearing the scrubs to a degree, but...
No, it's more like, well, I guess you can still call it the scrub pants, but at that point it's just like he's walking around in jeans.
I was going to say, after 5 years, I'm sure those scrubs like smell pretty bad.
And you know,
I don't think three is that great. I like two more.
But
I'm the outlier here, so clearly you may not agree with me. I never said I had great taste.
But it's got that sort of 3D brawler perspective, like Streets of Rage, and you're going through floor by floor of Rick's mansion this time, and you have to clear through a room, and then you have a few different doors open up. You have to pick which one to go through, and you have to sort of find the right path to the boss to beat it in enough time to get the good ending. And there's, like, bonus stages if you beat the game quick enough. At the very end, you fight the terror mask if you get the good ending and, you know, destroy it for good. And you have a power-up mode, too, where you find items, and when you pick them up, you fill up this meter, and once it's got any meter to it, you can push a button, Rick gets into, like, a mutant form and can hit enemies harder, you can choke them out, you can do some weird, like, body horror stretchy limbs out of his torso.
Yeah, the changes that they made for Splatterhouse 3 remind me a lot of Double Dragon 3, where they took sort of, you know, a simple beat-em-up and then tried to add this sort of, not quite RPG-ish, but adventure-ish element to it. You know, you can travel through the mansion, you're not just walking from left to right, but you're moving and kind of like following a map and trying to figure out where to go. I know if you lose your weapons, then you can go to a specific room on each floor and find the weapons again, so there's persistence. And, you know, you have to kind of balance, like, is it worth hunting down the weapons versus finishing the level within the, you know, the set amount of time and getting the proper ending? I don't know. It all seems pretty interesting to me, and it's I think it plays really well. But I guess my question is, you know, you two are, I would say, Splatterhouse traditionalists. So do you think that this game defies, like, violates the spirit of Splatterhouse, or do you think it's, you know, a valid take on the concept?
I think it's a valid take on the concept. I personally just don't quite enjoy it as much, but that doesn't make it bad, nor do I actually think it's bad. I just wasn't so into the changes, but I applaud them for deciding to innovate and try to change up the formula instead of repeating the same thing ad infinitum, which can definitely happen these days.
I really enjoyed it. You know, I really liked the first Splatterhouse. I didn't like 2 so much because it was very slavish to the first game's sort of style and rhythm. But 3, I mean, it doesn't succeed in everything it sets out to, but I really appreciate what it's trying to do, and I think it does a lot of it really well. And it's, I mean, it still keeps the weird goriness. It's got some kind of messed up digitized cutscenes, like a boar worm eating Jennifer's brain, which is pretty gross. But yeah, I think it's a solid game. This might be, next to Juan Paco Graffiti, the most inaccessible, because I don't think they brought it to Virtual Console or anything. I think you're stuck with the Genesis or the Splatterhouse 2010 version.
So this would be the last Splatterhouse game for 17 years. Do you think that was by design? Do you think Splatterhouse 3 feels like it was meant to be the natural ending of the series, or do you think it was just no one cared about it and they said, oh, well, the series is dead?
Yeah, I think based on how they were ending it, at the end of the game where you fight the mask and destroy it, I think they were looking at making this the last game in the series, and they just wanted to go out with everything they had at that point.
I also think horror as a whole was changing. I mean, even in 88, this game was sort of a throwback. There had been 8 or 7 Friday the 13th movies, and by the mid-90s, horror is becoming self-aware and less just like straight-up gore and, body horror, and it would eventually become
more towards the Scream.
Yeah, like Scream and New Nightmare, things like that. And then we would go into torture porn, but that would be a decade off. But yeah, I feel like
That's Splatterhouse 2010.
Yes, that's actually just torture, but Caitlin would disagree, I think.
So yeah, why don't we talk about Splatterhouse 2010? Because I think Caitlin is the outlier here as well.
I am.
She likes the game.
I don't love the game, but I like the game.
Right,
it's not a great game. But it's a good game.
So tell us what Splatterhouse 2010 is exactly.
It was a reboot for the 21st century or whatever of the Splatterhouse franchise, taking into account modern expectations of what gore levels would be commensurate with. Like, when they released Splatterhouse 88, that was extreme at that time. So they were trying to push the envelope similarly, and in some ways succeeded, in other ways failed, but they were attempting to push similar buttons with the envelope as they did before by adapting it for a current market.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a sense of, like, you know, this is a very angry kind of game. You've got Mastodon on the soundtrack, so right,
yeah.
There, that's kind of everything you need to know.
They might have skewed a little too heavily towards prepubescent male teenagers, and I mean, it's not that they're a market to be ignored, but you know, they added a system where you can collect pieces of pictures to get terrible 3D render pinups of Jennifer while you're trying to save her, and you're just
that's
lame.
Very much in keeping with
it's
sort
like
of,
Leisure Suit Larry kind of lame.
It's kind of keeping in with games of the 80s. You know, Rolling Thunder had Leela being disrobed as you get closer to saving her. There was also, of course, Minas Beach, that timeless classic by Color Dreams.
Color Dreams classic.
Yeah, so I kind of feel like a lot of Splatterhouse 2010's problems came from the fact that it basically was created in the murder shed of video
yeah.
game development. It was originally developed by a company called Bottle Rocket, and somewhere along the way, I don't know exactly what happened, but basically Namco, or Bandai Namco at this point, came in and they were the guy with the chainsaw, and Bottle Rocket was the fetuses hanging from the ceiling, and they came in with a chainsaw and cut them up and I think finished the game internally. So I think you can really see that this was sort of like a project that had a turbulent development life cycle and didn't feel quite complete.
Yeah, they did these really fun throwback sections where they did like this 2.5D, well, like it's still straight up 2D, but 3D renders of 2D environments, where you'd have the side-scrolling platforming areas as a throwback to the original series. They kept them appropriately brief and not too difficult, so they didn't really interfere. It was just kind of, it was clearly a love letter to the fans of the series. They just missed the mark on certain points. But you can't hate everything when you can, well, rectally fist a giant monster to pull out its insides. You know, it's kind of fun.
I guess.
Funsy. If you're a fan of gore and horror and probably the torture porn films, which sometimes hit or miss, but you can certainly find things to enjoy in it. And the great thing is that they still included the first three games entirely on the disc, which is why, whether or not you agree with my opinion on 2010 being at least worth a play, especially when you can get it for $15 to $17 usually, and you get the only really easily playable arcade port of the original besides the Wii Virtual Console. And it's not the worst value at all, even whether or not you like the game.
Do you know if the Xbox 360 version is backward compatible on Xbox One?
I believe it is. I'm not 100%.
So there is a reason to own an Xbox One.
Do you want to Google that? But
I'm
it should be. And the 360 version is preferable to the PS3 one. Better frame rates overall. Take your pick, but there's my advice.
So that game had a very difficult life and didn't really review that well. I don't think it sold that well. Do you think Splatter House deserves another shot at life, or do you think that its time has come and gone and, hey, the 80s and 90s were great, let's just leave it there and let our memories be happy?
I think it might be at the end of its life cycle, but I wouldn't hate it if somebody did try to reboot it, but maybe without trying to really aim too hard for that teenage prepubescent boy market. Like, it's not that I mind it, it just didn't really fit in with the feeling of the series, and it felt forced. Like I said, it felt kind of like a Leisure Suit Larry collectible item and not one that you find in Splatterhouse. Jennifer may have been a victim before, but she was also a transformed monster and you personally killed her, and now we've turned her into really ugly Uncanny Valley 3D fit-ups. It's not cute.
I kind of feel like the game is... it run its course. I mean, it's very much a product of its time, you know, the sort of 80s horror scene, and I don't even know why they bothered bringing it back in the first place, but I think it's fine where it's at, dead and buried in the murder shed.
I'm not kidding when I say this, but I think the spirit lives on in Resident Evil 7, because you are in a house of splatters, and you are often garbage of cesspool. But the non-joke part of that is I see a lot of the same ideas, a lot of the same inspirations, a lot of the same gore, and now it's all in VR, so it's even more horrific. So I feel like that is really where the spirit lives on.
And to just kind of wrap this up, if they did bring back Splatterhouse, what would you want to see? I personally would like to see Wanpaku Graffiti 2, but
oh, yeah,
that's just me.
Yeah, I'd say you could go with a parody of the 2010 Splatterhouse. I mean, it's kind of a self-parody already, but I think that would be really funny.
I think I'd like to see it, but I'd like to see it come out of a smaller studio, and that would be almost impossible to get the IP away from Bandai Namco. And I love Bandai Namco. That's not it. It's just I'd like to see a smaller studio, maybe. I mean, think Paul Robertson with Splatterhouse. And would you
that would
say
be awesome.
No?
I would say yes.
See, that's what I'm saying. So think maybe Tribute Games or even Yacht Club or somebody throwing some Paul Robertson, and I think you'd have a pretty amazing throwback game, but it would take the right team.
Yeah, okay. And Bob?
Oh, boy. I think, yeah, I mean, you kind of took the right out of my brain there just after you said Paul Robertson Splatterhouse. That's not, I want to see that. I think we should start a Patreon for that, or a Kickstarter, and just force him to do it against his will if he doesn't want to.
That's how video game development works.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it wouldn't be a change in the norm.
And, yeah, put him in the murder shed. Just, it always comes back to that.
He can't leave the murder shed until he finishes the game, so.
All right, so we are winding down, but we do have a few minutes if anyone has any questions or feedback and want to shout out to the team or the panelists.
You're going to be like Phil Donahue here, Jeremy.
This was rough up there for you guys. I actually had a question for the two of you, because you're probably beyond maybe the team that developed the game have the most hours put into Splatterhouse in general. And at the end of the game, there is a... There's a very fuzzy, low bitrate sound sample from Jennifer. And I'm wondering if between the two of you, if you've managed to figure out exactly what she is saying.
Do you mean the help me, Rick, or...
Yeah, I'm dying. It's hard to kind of
no,
discern
No, I believe it's an I'm dying.
Okay.
That's what I think it is. I've heard it so many times. Like, I know when I can start taking a drink during that game, stand up and stretch, do a little dance, because you can break dance. But
I can't break dance.
I think it's I'm dying, because that's when she literally transforms into a hideous beast and you have to kill her. Mm. So I'm dying is what I would say. If you need a second opinion, Rob Strangman would be a good choice.
I know in the home version, she's saying, help me. But I think it's a different sound sample than the arcade version.
Well, it's that there's two. She does say, help me, Rick, and I'm dying. So those are both valid. Right. They probably didn't have the space on the hue card. Probably didn't have the space on the hue card to fit the voice sample in.
Hey there. First of all, Bob, the Laser Time Facebook community says hi, and oh boy, Bobby. But for you two, so you said that the entire playthrough for a high score is only 40 minutes? Because that seems very short compared to other arcade games where you can spend playing hours trying to point press the score that you want.
One of the huge differences is that you do have a limited amount of lives, and each stage in Splatterhouse, the arcade version, there's a purple wall of fog and lightning that comes up behind you and forces you to move forward at a regular pace. And then once you get to the boss on each stage, there's a timer that begins, and once that timer limit is reached, a blue orb comes out, and it will continually come out, and they will deal one damage to you each until you're dead. So there's both an enforced time limit and maybe not a hard time limit, but as long as you can survive and you will die, time limit, as well as the game forcing you along otherwise. So there's a limited amount of time you could spend playing the game. The longest possible way to play the game would be to farm the last boss for points, which is, like I mentioned, an exploit, but the final boss timer, I believe, is something like 12 minutes until the blue orb spawns, and you would have to wait out the 12 minutes each time, each life on that stage, to wait for the blue orb to kill you, to kill the boss simultaneously and get the 100,000 point bonus. So that would be the longest way to play the game. Otherwise, you're looking at 45 to 60 minutes realistically.
And I think that wraps it up. So thank you, everyone, for coming out to see us this year. But thank you, Kevin and Caitlin, for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks also, Bob, for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome.
There's no getting away from Bob.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that wraps it up for this year's Retronauts panel. So thanks again, and we hope to see you tonight.
Thanks, everybody.
And caller number 9 for $1 million. Rita, complete this quote. Life is like a box of...
chocolates.
Rita, you're cutting out. We need your answer.
Life is like a box of chocolates.
Oh, sorry. That's not what we were looking for. On to caller number 10.
Bad network got you glitched out of luck? Switch to Boost Mobile, super reliable, super fast nationwide network, and get 4 lines, each with unlimited gigs for just $100 a month. Plus, get 4 free phones. Boost makes it easy to switch. Switching makes it easy to save.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.